You know, we build these worlds that are based upon values that make sense for an economy, but that don't make sense for us as individual Homo sapiens. And then we wonder why we're not happy. You know, it's like we're wearing shoes that are not shaped like a human foot. It's not to be comfortable. And yet we're trying to cram our feet into these strangely shaped shoes. Much better to go barefoot.
Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's Breathcast guest is Dr. Chris Ryan, PhD. And Chris is the author of Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death. And he has a very big podcast called Tangentially Speaking. And I've been listening to that podcast since about 2013, 2014. And Chris has absolutely changed my life. Listening to this person and his stories about travel and life and sex and health and all these things. And I just remember very early into podcast listener, who the heck is this guy? He was on Joe Rogan. And I just aligned with his thoughts and feelings. And I've been an avid listener of his podcast ever since. So I can't even begin to share my excitement and happiness that I got to sit down and ask Chris questions, because it is a dream. It really is. He didn't disappoint. We talk a bit about breath work as well, but this is so much more than that. You know, we're talking about life and death and travel and what it means to be alive right now, how to live a good life. And I really think you're going to get so much from this breathcast, this podcast. I've linked to some of Chris's stuff down below, so make sure you go and follow Chris on Twitter. Check out his website. Interestingly, I'm also supporting Chris now, as we've built a connection. I'm actually supporting him with his YouTube channel. So you can go over and you can follow his YouTube channel, where I'm actually putting episodes of his podcast on, which again is an absolute dream. To work with this guy in any way is wonderful. So I'm properly geeking out here, and I'm totally fine with that. Before we get stuck into this amazing conversation, just a couple of bits I want to share with you. So number one is this podcast is brought to you in conjunction with our other channel, Hypnotherapy Unleashed. And as you know, breathwork is a very powerful tool that can help with the mind and de-stress, help us think clearer, get more energy, get more clarity. Hypnotherapy is another tool that does that as well. So no matter what it is that you're kind of working on, whether it's maybe some form of addiction, stress, anxiety, depression, and a whole host of other things, Hypnotherapy Unleashed is a platform that's completely free. It's on YouTube, and you can go in there, and we've got, I don't know, over 50 videos now specific to different niches. It's completely free. They range from sort of 15 to 20 minutes all the way up to an hour. We use different music as well to help embed the learning and really get the brain into different states. And so I think it's something that if you really do like breath work and you're searching for healing, then I think Hypnotherapy Unleashed would be an additional tool for your playlist belt. So please click on the link below and subscribe to that. We would really appreciate it, as we're really trying to grow that channel. You can follow me on Instagram. It's takeadeepbreath.co.uk. And if you could leave a comment, like, and I know not all of you are subscribed, so if you could subscribe below, that would be incredible. If you are listening to this on iTunes, if you could leave us a star review, a couple of stars, 3 stars, 4 stars, ideally 5 stars, that would be incredible, because we're really trying to grow the podcast and get the word out there about conscious breathing. Now, it is my absolute honor and privilege to introduce to you Dr. Chris Ryan, PhD. So take it away. Here we go. Cheers. Mr. Chris Ryan, thank you so much for being on the Take a Deep Breath podcast. It is an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and one of my dreams come true as well. Although I'm often reminded by something I think you said on the podcast a number of years ago, which I think you were talking about Brad Pitt, and you said, the problem is they know that their shit stinks. Now, I might be misquoting you a little bit, but I often think about that, about all these celebrities, but they know that their shit stinks. And that's that piece, isn't it, around we all kind of maybe start to think of ourselves, you know, I've become a bit of a podcaster, but actually I still know that I've got a lot of faults and problems. But anyway, I think this is going to be quite a tangent podcast. What I was hoping to do today with you, sir, is just talk about a bit about your books, a bit about your background. I wrote a few questions down, but really the emphasis of today would be, I would just love to pick your brains a bit about what it means to live a life today, and your thoughts on what it means to live a good life And actually a good death as well. I was listening to the last bit of your book, Civilized to Death, again late earlier, just to familiarise myself with some bits and these hermetically sealed caskets and all these things. So I'm just wanting to delve into all these different areas with you, and we'll see what we can get to in the next sort of 60 minutes. I guess my first question for you would be, how are you coping with the pandemic and the lockdown situation? How's that been for you over the last sort of 12 months?
Well, I guess it's been pretty easy for me compared to most people. I don't have a job in the service industry that I've lost, right? I was working remotely from home anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's not a shift. I don't have kids who are, home from school that I have to deal with unexpectedly, or, scramble around for childcare.
Yes.
My mother's doing okay. She's 80 years old, and so she's my main concern, but she's fine. I had started having food delivered to her. I there's a guy named Tyler, as a friend of mine, he has a company called Sunbasket, and he sponsored my podcast for a while, and then as a way to sort of get to know the service that I was talking about on the podcast, I ordered the service for my mom, and they deliver sort of like ready to cook meals, and we started that before the whole pandemic started. So luckily that was already going. So she doesn't need to go to the grocery store, and she's super happy just hanging out alone, and I call her up. So basically long story short, my life was kind of already pretty much set up to deal with something like this.
Yeah.
So I feel very fortunate that I'm not dealing with, all the stressors and economic impact that a lot of people are.
Yeah.
So it's not, my one complaint is that I kind of like to spend the winters someplace tropical. And this year I wasn't able to do that for the first time in a few years. And that's a bummer. But, come on, talk about first world problems,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I've been always missing you. Not that we would have ever have had the chance to probably meet up, but I remember a couple of years ago you were in South Africa and I'd just come back from there, and then I was in Asia, and I remember listening to your podcast. I know there's probably a delay in the podcast, and I was like, oh, he was so close again to me. And then I think you're in Spain a little bit, but no, so I've got a day job and I've got the Take a Deep Breath on the side, and I'm lucky that I've got this office and I do both things in this room. I want to get into your book, Civilized Death, a little bit. And obviously it came out before the pandemic. And I think I've been thinking, what have we evolved into now? Or what's the next step here? Because I'm very lucky. I've not really been affected by the pandemic. I've got my day job. I'm doing this on the side. I've got a lovely house that I get to be in. It's safe and secure and very comfortable. But I don't spend my time with any other humans all day. I'm in this box by myself all day, talking to people on the screen. When I had my day job before, I used to have meetings for 90% of my working day, and I'd be, as a mid-management level, talking to different people, eye to eye, person to person, shaking hands, sometimes a hug, depending on how well we get together. But now I sit in this room and I stare at this screen at this distance now for sometimes 10 hours a day. And it's starting to take its toll a little bit. And I'm thinking, is this the next step of civilized evolution, where we're too scared to mingle anymore and this becomes the new norm? So I'd love to just get your thoughts on some of that.
Yeah, well, in so many ways, what we're going through now, I think, has accelerated pre-existing trends, right? And so social isolation, the fragmentation of extended families and community, and these are all things that I wrote about in Civilized to Death, the sort of shift from getting together with people that you meet in the course of your life versus swiping on a dating app, just very different ways of interacting that generally have sort of, the trajectory has been away from community and into isolation. More people live alone right now than have ever lived alone in the existence of our species.
Yeah.
And that's taking a very dramatic effect on our mental health. Depression is way up, and this is all before the pandemic. So I'm just talking about what was already happening.
Yes.
you know, ordering on Amazon rather than going to the store. You know, it's just so yeah, it does seem that this particular pandemic has an accelerant to these trends. And but in another way, I feel like maybe this is an opportunity to get the pendulum swinging the other way. So, for example, I'm in a very small town right now in Colorado, where 10 years ago, the population was probably maybe a fifth of what it is right now, because a lot of people are coming here. The real estate market's going crazy. People are building here. Now I'm talking like I'm in the middle of nowhere, but people are coming out here because they want clean air, because they're set free by remote working, right? Yeah. They're set free by the realization that they can sell their house in Dallas or Denver or LA and get a similar structure here for a fifth of the cost, much higher quality of life, beautiful dark skies at night, you know, nature all around. Quality of life is no longer tied to a particular place. And so people are starting to learn, what's the phrase, you know, arbitrage, international arbitrage. You know, you make your money one place and you spend it in a place where it's worth more. You've done that traveling, I'm sure. So I think it's, you know, as always, there's it's a double-edged sword, these things. You know, we can find ways to put them to good use and use them as motivation. I think a lot of people are starting to look at the American dream and see, or the British dream or the French dream or wherever you are, and see that it's not generationally, we're not going to have as much money as our parents, not going to have as much financial security. So what do we do about that? Well, one thing that people are doing is getting together with their friends and saying, hey, why don't we take care of each other? Because the state isn't going to take care of us, right? So I on my podcast, I talk about setting up lifeboats because the ship is sinking, right? Mm. The ship of state is going down. So we need to take care of each other and take care of ourselves. So, you know, I have friends who are coming here to live with us. And the idea being that, you know, we have a very close friend who's an auto mechanic. And so he knows how to fix things, and his wife takes care of chickens. And, you know, this other guy's a carpenter. And so everybody's got a skill.
Yeah.
And we share tools, and we, you know, we're going to all go work on his house next week. And then the week after, we're going to work on someone else's house. So we're saving money. Yeah. So sort of set up your own community, your own barter system, your own extended family or tribe, or, you know, hunter-gatherer band, or whatever your however you frame it. The point is that we as a species thrive on cooperation and community and sharing, and the pull of society is pulling us away from the very things that make us happy and healthy. So that's what my work is about. That's what Civilized to Death is about largely. And Sex at Dawn is sort of the same message, but in a more intimate context, I guess.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. I've heard you talk about this lifeboat. And funnily, actually, I think you had one of your video chats where you put the audio on your podcast, and somebody was asking where they should set their lifeboat up. And one of the places they're asking about was Poland, but they didn't speak the language. Now, funnily enough, my girlfriend is Polish, and we live here in England at the minute. I love Poland. They've got beautiful mountains. It's a good economy for, you know, especially if you're British. And there's things out there which I just don't see in England. They pickle. My girlfriend's mum pickles her own pickles. You know, we don't do that here. Her grandma grows vegetables still. She's like 89, 90, and she's got like a big garden of stuff, and she's, you know, active doing that sort of thing. Whereas here, it's probably similar to America, very much a supermarket culture. The garden is nothing, you know, it's a tiny bit of grass. So I have these dreams of being able to get away from where we are and getting into a more rounded society. But I was going to ask you this, actually. I struggle at the minute between, and this is not a great metaphor, but I see you as this great traveler, and you've inspired me so much. So I went traveling, met Wim Hof, and we can talk a bit about some of that stuff. But then on the, and it's not extreme polar opposites, but then I also look at Joe Rogan, and there's this guy that seems to cram everything in. And I think you've said before, when you were talking about Elon Musk, I think, and you're like, we look at you, Joe, and say, how do you get all these things done in one day? You know, all these different things he's done. And I struggle on that bar between which side should I be? And right now I'm leaning more towards the Joe Rogan, and it's only prepping for this interview where I've thought I've lost my way a little bit, because if I go back to a year and a half ago, I was traveling, we were staying in hostels, we were living off, you know, a couple of pounds, couple of dollars a day, trying to live as cheap as we could. And I've got to this point now where I'm working two jobs, working, you know, ridiculous hours a day, trying to get the business going here and stuff and meet all these great people. And so I would just love to get your thoughts. Have you bounced between the scale of you and Joe a little bit? Because I guess you've had books go out there and you've done all these things. Or has your core always been the Chris Ryan core of, I'm going to have a beer at the end of the night because I need to relax and look at the stars and all that romantic stuff?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to talk about and think about. You know, I love Joe. He's someone I really admire, and I've gotten to know him personally, and you know, I have nothing bad to say about that guy. But I do feel like people like him are, you know, we talk about people who are driven. And I think that there's something underlying that drive that is not necessarily pleasant. And, you know, I don't want to get in psychoanalyze Joe or anybody else, but I feel like the natural state of a human being is relaxed, and ambition is a very dangerous, addictive drug, because when you're ambitious in an external sense, you're ambitious for fame or for money or, you know, any kind of achievement, then you become dependent upon the feedback that you get for that achievement, and your happiness depends upon achieving. And whatever it is that you have decided is your path of achievement, that path is going to come to an end, or it's going to run into, you know, difficulties. For example, I used to live, you've probably heard me talk about when I lived in this mansion with all these fashion models, right?
Yeah.
So here are people who have largely sort of based their self-worth on their beauty and how much they can monetize that beauty. But what happens when you get to be 25 or 30 and that beauty starts to fade? Then who are you, right? Then you have a crisis because you've externalized your self-worth. And so I think that's always a mistake, and it's something that I have always sort of instinctively been very wary of. So, you know, when I was young and people would, you know, professors or whatever would say, man, you should be a writer, you're a good writer, my first instinct was, no, I don't want to get into this sort of chasing success. Like, I don't have anything to say. Why? The only reason I would write at this stage in my life when I'm 25 or whatever I was, 20, is for attention. And making myself hungry for that attention weakens me. Right. So the things that I found, you know, you can be ambitious for internal growth. And I think that's the way wisdom lies, you know. And what I love about Joe is, like, yeah, Joe gets a lot done. Joe's a stand-up comic. Joe's, you know, making a ton of money, and he's, you know, but I think if you talk to Joe about his most important successes, he would say it's being a good father, it's being a good man, being a good husband. I think you're being a good friend, certainly. And so the other stuff is sort of, it comes along with that. But I don't admire Joe because he's rich or famous. I admire Joe because he's a good friend and he's a good person. So I think that kind of ambition makes sense. But don't locate your self-worth outside in your money or your fame or whatever, because that's all bullshit.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, getting back to Brad Pitt's shit. You know, I think that's the key, that the people who become famous and get a lot of this admiration and, you know, attention, that sort of sets them up in an imposter syndrome situation where they know they're just people. They're just, yeah. I'm just a dude, right? I'm just a guy. And, you know, in Brad Pitt's case, it's like, okay, I'm super good looking, but what did I do for that? It's not like I worked really hard to get this jawline, you know, he knows that. And to the extent that he forgets that, he will start to get crazy because it sets up a conflict between what he's pretending to be and what he knows he is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we see this in people who rise. You know, some people become famous and they handle it, and other people become famous and they fall apart. And I think in many cases, the people who fall apart are the people who haven't resolved the conflict between what they're being told they are and what they know they are.
That's it almost hit me with a bit of a wet fish there when you said that, because a lot of that stuff resonated a lot. And I think about, are you familiar with David Goggins?
Yeah, I know who he is, and I know he has a book called like Nothing Can Hurt Me or something like that. And I know I think he's a friend of Joe's, or at least he's been on Joe's podcast. I haven't listened to it, but I do think about that because I see someone, you know, I've got a buddy who's a Navy SEAL, and you know, I know some of these, you know, life hackers, biohackers, you know, everything's optimal and, you know, functioning at the absolute highest level. And they're, you know, Ironman triathletes and all this shit. And, you know, I always feel like I feel a little sad for people. And again, I don't mean this about David Goggins because I don't know him personally at all, but people who are setting themselves up as being invulnerable are, I think that's the wrong path. You embrace your vulnerability. You don't pretend there is none. You are, you know, I don't care how tough you are, how strong you are, how much you work out, how many vitamins you take, and how, you know, your fiber content, you're gonna get old, you're gonna get fucking sick, you're gonna die. Deal with that.
Yes,
get ready for that. And to the extent that all this, you know, working out and this attention to the physical is a denial of these immutable realities of biological life, these people are just setting themselves up for much more pain down the road.
Yeah.
So, you know, nothing can hurt me. Fuck off. Of course things can hurt you.
Yeah.
I don't care how tough you are as a human being, any weak ass bear can take you, right? Like you're not humans are not a particularly impressive species.
No.
The fastest human is way slower than the slowest leopard, you know, like forget about it. You know, if our teeth are ridiculously dull, we've got no claws, we're not very coordinated. Any chimpanzee can, you know, take out four Joe Rogans and David Goggins. So I just think there's the humility is an acceptance are more likely to lead to happiness and the kind of growth that is really going to be worth something over the long run. In fact, Joe and I talked about this, I think the last time I was on his podcast, cause he was sort of making fun of me cause I don't work out a lot. And then I was making fun of him cause he works out too much. And, you know, we were sort of playing with that theme. And I remember that he wrote an essay. I don't remember if it was in Men's Health or one of those magazines. And it was really interesting because the essay was that your body is like a sand painting. And you can spend lots of time working on your body, but you're still going to get old and you're still going to die. It's still going to break down. It's still temporary.
Yeah.
And I was really happy to see someone like Joe spreading that message, you know, that you're not going to avoid these things. I think a lot of what's going on right now in Silicon Valley with, you know, this life extension frenzy. There's lots of money, hundreds of millions, yes, maybe billions of dollars going into this stuff. Aubrey Dubray, I think his name is, mm-hmm, is one of the leading thinkers in that area. I mean, they're selling this idea that you're going to stop aging and that people are going to live forever.
Yeah,
this is just nonsense. This is the same snake oil that's been sold for centuries. And instead of trying to live forever, try to live today.
Yeah.
You know, instead of trying to extend, you know, there are two dimensions. There's the dimension of length and there's the dimension of depth. And I think to the extent that we're obsessed on the length of our lives and we lose sight of focusing on the depth of our lives, I think this is a mistake.
Mm. Yeah, I was listening to your death chapter. I don't know if it's called that, but the chapter where he talks a lot about death and civilized death and the extension. And I can't remember the exact figures, but a ridiculous percentage in America of the Medicare costs go towards the final weeks and months. And I'd forgotten that. And it was just shocking listening to that today. And I don't think we have quite the same problem here in England. We've got the NHS and stuff. But there is definitely that element of let's keep that person alive as long as we can, because anything other than that is a defeat. And yet I had to put my dog down a few years ago and I was being humane. And so there's that weird contradiction going on there. Where do you get your death philosophy thinking from? Because I see you as somebody that's like, do you know what? I'm going to die one day and that's okay. And I've had a really good life and that's okay. And don't give me any CPR. Don't keep me plugged into any machines. And when I hear that, part of me's like, yeah, I want to be with Chris on that. But another part of me's going, yeah, but if you can maybe keep me alive a bit longer, there's always a chance I might get better. And so it's that weird dichotomy that I have there. So yeah, where does that come from for you? Because it feels like you've got quite a really healthy acceptance of death.
I think it comes from several different places and it has been reinforced through experience. So the first place it comes from, and I don't know if I've talked about this publicly before, but when I was really young, I remember having a sense that where I came from, like on a cosmic level before I was born, was a really good place, really comfortable and happy and blissful. I'm talking when I was 9, 10, 11 years old, something like that. And then as my sort of verbal brain or mind started to dominate the non-verbal aspects of my consciousness, I remember having this sense that I am losing this memory. And it's a memory that's going to be really important for me to have later in my life. And so what I can't stop losing it because I'm losing the connection, the sort of direct connection that I had with that state of consciousness. But I need to sort of like build a monument in my brain to this so that I will remember that I once remembered this. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's almost like I want to take a photo of this thing that is fading so that I'll have the photo, yeah, even though I won't have the memory itself, I'll have the photo of the memory and I can refer to that, mm-hmm, later. And so it's one of my earliest memories, this idea like, don't worry about dying because, you know, when you die, you just go back to where you were before you were born. And I remember that where I was before I was born was great. So chill, enjoy yourself, right? Yeah. Don't spend your life worrying about it because it's fine. So I had that memory and then I sort of lost the memory, but I had the memory of the memory. Mm-hmm. And then the first time I did psychedelics, which was mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, Halloween night, 1980. I was 18 years old, I guess, my first year in college. And I had this overwhelming sense of familiarity when I was tripping, like, wow, okay, it's the first time I've ever done this, but this feels so familiar to me. Like, yeah, like this is reality and the rest of it is an act or a, you know, a diluted version of this. And one aspect of it was this lack of fear of death. And so, you know, as I used psychedelics subsequently, part of what I was exploring there and sort of reinforcing was this consciousness, this posture of consciousness where I am going, my purpose here is to enjoy life, to savor life, to be grateful for this life, and not to lose that focus by worrying about it, the fact that it's transitory in some way, which I saw all around me people were doing, right?
Yeah.
People were not enjoying themselves because they were so worried about losing this thing that they were not enjoying anyway. It was like, whether you're missing the whole point here, you know? And then I remember I did a Vipassana, one of those 10-day silent retreats in Spain. And I the teaching was about, you know, enjoying something. It was about this. It was about how do you enjoy something without clinging to it, right? One of the central teachings of Buddhism is about this. How do you enjoy something without then wanting to preserve it forever and hold on to it and, you know, thereby strangle it in many cases. And I was walking by myself out in this field behind the place where we were doing the meditation. And it was at night and I was thinking about this and I looked up and a shooting star went down through the sky and it was like, wow, cool. And then it was gone. And then I realized like, I'm not bummed out that it's gone. I'm just bathing in gratitude that it ever happened at all, right? Yeah. That I got to see that. And so that sort of became a, you know, a recurring image in my mind. Like this, you know, if you are worried about preserving life too much and you're too scared of death, then you're the person who doesn't really even see the shooting star, because the second it starts to fall, you're like, oh no, it's gonna end. Yeah. Oh, I knew it would end. Like, you just wasted the whole fucking experience.
Yeah.
Man. So anyway, I don't know. I mean, that it's always been a theme, obviously, because, you know, I think life is enriched by understanding and keeping death near.
Yeah.
And then of course I worked in hospitals in Spain for a long time. I was doing research with oncologists for years. So I was around a lot of people who were in the process of dying and doctors who worked with a lot of people who died. And then I, you know, was married to a doctor for 20 years. And, you know, so a lot of the people I spent time with were around death, and it was, you know, not a taboo subject. And then my father died 2.5 years ago. And, you know, that's unavoidably an important transition, I think, for anybody. And I'll tell you, I feel like the grieving process for my father has been, very much lightened by my knowledge of the fact that he enjoyed his life, you know? So I think, you know, if my father had sacrificed his own happiness, you know, had been really unhappy in some terrible job that he didn't like, or married to a woman he didn't love, or, you know, if he had missed the opportunity to live his life, I think I would grieve. The weight of his death would weigh on me much more heavily. So, you know, by living your life fully and happily and really savoring it, you're actually doing a favor for people who love you. Because when you die, they're going to say, you know what? Hey, Mike had a good run, you know? Yeah. Let's raise a toast to him and, you know, have a good night. And like, as opposed to poor Mike, you know, poor Mike, he never really got off the ground. He never really went anywhere. He never did what he wanted to do. That's sad. But someone who lived a good life, you know, there's nothing sad in the ending.
Yeah. Quality over quantity. But we, it's so easy to focus on the quantity, isn't it, over the quality. And I try to have gratitude, and it's so easy for it to just fall three fingers. It's like, I've got eyes, I've got ears, I can walk, I can communicate, I've got an education. And I try and journal these things now and again. And when I'm in the mode, it's like, oh, this is great. And I can feel a bit of gratitude. But then something random happens in your day-to-day civilized life and it just throws you out of whack. And it's something so silly. And yesterday is a good example of what you're talking about. So I had so much work to do for Take a Deep Breath. And I was like, I need to crack on. And we've just got a new puppy, a little German Shepherd, which we brought back from Poland. And lovely, but also destructive as anything. She just wants to eat things that don't belong to her. If I panned the camera down now, all you would see here is cardboard where she was in just before I hit record. Anyway, I love her to bits.
You've invited a wolf into your house, man. Yeah, like, what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah. My previous dog was just a little lap dog, and he was lovely. And and this one is a wolf. Yeah, absolutely. But yes, my girlfriend's like, right, we should go to there's a big national park nearby. She goes, we should go there for a couple of hours. It was snowing. I said, I haven't really got time for that. She goes, come on, let's go. And I got out, and it was snowing, and dog was loving it. It's the first time I've been to this national park, and it was the highlight of my day yesterday. I didn't give a crap about all the other stuff. And it's like, if the only thing that happened yesterday was going for the walk, it was a good day, and it was a good day. But I would have easily sacrificed that for cracking on with all of this work stuff. So I don't know what the answer to that is. It's taking more time out, I guess, and thinking more about, like you just said, how does Mike, or how does Chris, or how does anybody have that good life? And how do you catch yourself? I don't know if you have any suggestions here, but it's easy to get seduced by comfort and the ego. And it's like, how can you, and when you're in it, you don't notice sometimes, do you? But maybe you're better trained in this. But how, any advice how you can catch that and go, hang on a second, the ego's taking over a little bit here. I need to slow down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, for some people, a meditation practice is an important part of that. I think that's one reason that people value meditation, because it's a time where you turn off all that stuff and you focus on what is ego, what is the voice of the ego talking to you. Mm-hmm. I think any experience that you have that reduces life down to its essentials isn't enlightening in that respect. So, for example, I try to spend 3 or 4 months every year living in my van, right? And you know, it's amazing. Like, you know, my friend and I spent, I think it was 4 months this past summer in the van, and we've got all the stuff in a storage locker. And I said to her, like, is there anything in that storage locker that you've missed in the last 4 months? She's like, no. I was like, me either. Like, why? We're paying all this money for all this crap in the store. We don't need it. We've just lived great for 4 months without that stuff, you know? Yeah. Now, we did not burn down the storage locker. You know, we got a lot of that stuff still. But the point is that, you know, build into your life these reminders of what really matters, I guess, is my point. Yeah. So whether it's, and it's always a reduction, right? It's never an adding. You don't need to buy anything. You need to get rid of stuff or have, you know, live your life in a way that you don't need those things. So, you know, camping, I think is a great one. You know, just going for a long walk with your dog, having a dog. I think that's one of the reasons that people have pets is like, you know, you see this animal, it's like, that animal is so damn happy. You give him a new box to rip up and he's like just pure happiness for a while, you know? And I think that's one of the sources of insight is being around non-human animals or children, right? Mm-hmm. Like seeing what makes that five-year-old kid happy. It's not the iPad. It's being outside. It's running. It's, you know, doing cartwheels. It's running into the ocean or a lake or, you know, swinging on a rope. It's very simple things. And to the extent that we get away from those things, I think, you know, again, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We think we're being sophisticated and, you know, people think that they're superior when they need a higher, when it takes more to make them happy. So I think in Civilized to Death, I talked about this in terms of wine, right? Mm-hmm. Like I lived in Spain for a long time and I drank a lot of wine in Spain. And I found that I was very happy with, like, my favorite wines cost about 10 euros a bottle, right? That's mm-hmm. the sweet spot for me. Now I have friends, we go over for dinner and they pull out this wine. It costs 80, 90, 100 euros a bottle.
Yeah.
And I drink it and it's like, I honestly don't notice the difference and I don't want to, right? Because I don't want to have to earn 100 euros to buy a bottle of wine that will make me happy. Mm. I don't want to have this super refined taste. I want my taste to be pretty damn simple so that I can just enjoy things that I can afford rather than having to work harder to get things that will bring me pleasure, you know? Yeah. So I think we shoot ourselves in the foot that way. You know, someone who's like, you know, like I've dated women who, when I said something about, you know, living in a hut on a beach in Thailand, you can see them sort of go like, oh my God, no, that's not for me. And it's like, okay, deal breaker, you know, because there's no way that I'm going to try to make you happy by spending $1,000 a night in some resort. That's just not going to happen, you know? So I think keeping our tastes very basic and, you know, think about it in culinary terms, like fresh vegetables that are lightly cooked with a little olive oil, taste the vegetable. Don't bury it in cheese sauce or, you know, something that buries the flavor of the experience itself. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm talking a lot and saying very little. No, it's basically everything boils down to quality over quantity, right? It's all about enjoy the experience itself and don't be distracted by the nonsense. And of course, the nonsense is generated by a capitalist system that wants us to keep buying things. It's trying to enslave us. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important that we learn to ignore the messages that are coming at us from this system and learn to focus our attention on the messages that are coming to us from the natural world and from within ourselves, which are in concert in telling us that simplicity and love and, you know, kindness and a campfire and looking at the stars or the sunset or the sunrise, these are the things that make us happy, not the latest iPhone and gadgets and things that cost lots of money.
Yeah. We when I was married and we moved house, we had so much stuff. And in the attic, not the house, but the attic, there was 30 boxes of stuff. And that was a really dark time because the marriage was kind of ending and there's all this stuff everywhere. Anyway, fast forward a little bit. Me and my girlfriend went traveling back end of 2018 and we sold the bed. We sold the car and we put about 4 boxes of stuff into my parents' attic. And that's all that we had between us. And I couldn't even now tell you what was in there. Just, you know, spatulas and things that you don't really want to buy again when you're starting, or some cutlery or something. But it was such a great feeling to be getting to nearly 40, but having nothing really. And knowing that that was okay, because you don't need it to have a great life. And we had a great, you know, year traveling, and none of me was going, oh, I'm a bit worried about the stuff, because there's no need to worry about it. It's just baggage weighing me down. So as I've then come back and re-entered society, I'm really trying to think very carefully. I'm not a minimalist at all, but I try and think very carefully about, what's this purchase going to do? Is it going to weigh me down? Am I going to have to service that car now because I've owned it? And is it just going to cause more problems? And can I get the bus or the bike and that sort of thing? I want to talk to you a bit about Spain, actually, because you brought Spain up. Have you ever done part or all of the Camino? I heard you mention it before.
No, I've been to lots of places along it, but I've never walked it. Mm. No,
it's right up your street, and I'm sure you've done things very similar to it. But I read a book before I went, and the author described it as it's a life within a life, and I loved this term. And he goes, and as you know that you're getting to the end, you know that the inevitable death is coming of that life, and at the very start of it, you're by yourself, and I went by myself. And then I made some friends, I made some really good friends, and we were a little gang. And then we kind of went off in our own directions halfway through. And it really did feel like, well, I'm a teenager now, I'm middle aged now, I'm getting towards the end. And then there was that inevitable death where we all went off, and we were from all over the planet. And yes, we've got Facebook, but we all went back to our corners of the planet again. And that was such a transformative time for me. But knowing that there was that death at the end, fast forward into after the travel, I kind of had this sense, and I think you've spoke about this a little bit today, I kind of got to this point without being morbid, I was going, it's okay if I die now. And it was the weirdest feeling I got. And I don't necessarily feel that today, but when I got back from traveling and Wim Hof and some other bits we might talk about later, I just kind of got to this point going, that's okay. I feel like I've not done enough, but going back to your analogy about the funeral, or, you know, the person's had a good life, I kind of feel that at 40, like the rest of it's gravy for me now. It doesn't matter what really happens next. But then on the fast forward again a little bit to now, the ego's taking control again. It's going to know, but you need to work harder. You need to get some money in the bank. You need to get some more possessions. You need to get a nice car. So I feel like today's podcast has been very apt for me, because talking to you, it's been a little bit of a reset. I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to this again. But is there any other advice or wisdom that you can give, maybe from your traveling days, that has stayed with you and kept you grounded now? Because I know you've been to India, and I can't imagine what that must have been like in sort of the 80s and 90s. Was there things that you saw in your travels that have kind of shaped more who you are today that you can reference?
Oh man, that's a huge question. You know, I traveled all through my 20s and most of my 30s, you know, depending how we define travel. I lived in Spain through my 30s and 40s, pretty much, you know, quite a bit of traveling in there as well. There's so many things. The first major trip that I did was, I was in university and I found a loophole in the way that the university was set up, that I could basically skip a year and still graduate on time and save my parents a bunch of money because they were paying the bill. And so I went to the administration and I said, look, you know, according to this, I've done this and that, and so I don't really need to be here. And they're like, what? That can't be. And they looked at it and they were like, oh damn, you're right. But then they immediately changed everything so no one else could do it. But I skipped my junior year, my third year in university. And I thought, okay, well, I've got a year off. I need to be back here next year, but I've got this year off. So what should I do? And I always wanted to go to a frontier. Like at that time, I was reading Herman Melville and Joseph Conrad and all these sort of adventure literature, you know, kind of both spiritual and physical, you know, journeys. And so I thought, okay, I want to go to Alaska because that's the frontier. That's like where I can actually get to the edge of the civilized world a little bit, right? And going to the Amazon or something, or you know, somewhere in Africa, was outside of my realm of imagination at that point. And also finances, because my parents agreed they would give me the money that I was spending on food in the university to fund my travels if I wanted to go somewhere. But that wasn't a lot, right? It was a few hundred bucks a month or something. So I decided to hitchhike to Alaska. And, you know, I was, you know, not to talk about ego, I had a lot of ego at that point in my life. I was a really good student. I was friends with the professors. I was winning all these awards. I was, you know, on this track to go to actually to Oxford, because I had a professor who was a big shot at Oxford and he was going to pull some strings and I was going to go to Oxford and do a PhD and be, you know, get tenure and blah, blah, blah. So I had this sort of path set out of my life, and I took this year and I went to Alaska and I hitchhiked from New York to Alaska, which is, I don't even know, 1500 miles or it's a lot. Oh, yeah. It's across North America. And that was very strange, because that was, you know, in the 60s and 70s, people hitchhiked. But by the 80s, nobody was really hitchhiking anymore. It was, you were hitchhiking because you just got out of prison and didn't have any money. You know, you were schizophrenic, or there weren't like a lot of people like me hitchhiking. The hippie thing was all done.
Right.
So I met a lot of really interesting characters hitchhiking, people that I never would have met in my fancy university, you know, or the suburbs where I grew up. And some of the people that I met were really smart, but in ways that their intelligence manifested in ways that I had never really seen before. So, you know, I'm coming from a place where I'm hanging out with everybody's got PhDs, everyone's IQ is off the charts. You know, they went to Yale and Harvard and Princeton and all these places and super, super smart. But they didn't know how to do anything. Their relationships were a mess. You know, they didn't know how to change a light bulb or, you know, fix the air conditioner. They always had to call somebody, and a lot of sort of class arrogance, you know, looking down at the working class, you know, these poor people who, you know, never don't know who Nietzsche is, or, you know, wouldn't know a Beethoven symphony from a Brahms lullaby. You know, it's like, and then I'm with these people who pick me up. I remember this one guy in particular, he picked me up in the middle of nowhere, somewhere in the Yukon Territory, I think in Canada. And he took me to his house, and, you know, he had built the house himself, and it was this beautiful log cabin, and his wife and kids were there, and they were really cool, and they really loved him. And he had a bunch of dogs that were, they were like half Alaskan Malamute and half wolf, because he used them as sled dogs, and he was breeding them, and these dogs were awesome. And he had a big garden, and I think they had chickens, I don't remember, but they were like really self-sufficient, and you could tell they loved each other and respected each other. And he had this, you know, it's just like, dude, your life is awesome. And you know how to fix your car. You know how to build this, you know how to, you know, hunt and butcher an animal to feed your family. And I just remember thinking, like, this guy is so far from the world that I've been living in. And he has accepted me. And then he gave me a ride back out to the highway the next day, like an hour drive, you know.
Nice.
And he has accepted me into his world with all this generosity and kindness. But if this guy fell into my world, if this guy, you know, ended up at the university, and my friends wouldn't accept him, they wouldn't be kind to him, they wouldn't invite him into their world. And I realized, like, I'd rather be like this guy than like those professor friends of mine. And I realized, like, I'm on the wrong path. Like, I'm operating out of ego. I'm operating out of, like, I'm going to be another, you know, talking about imposter syndrome, right? I'm going to be another one of these professors who's talking about these books that are all about experiences that I've never had.
Yes.
And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be lying to kids, you know, or transmitting someone else's experiences. I want to have my own experiences. I want to have my own life. And so that summer in Alaska, I reconfigured my life, and I said, okay, I'm not going to grad school. I'm not committing to a job or a career or a woman or anything else until I'm 30. And I am going to spend at least a decade floating around the world, having experiences before I make any commitments to anything or anyone. And I'll lose 10 years. Like, if I decide, oh, actually, I want to be a surgeon, well, I'm going to be applying to med school at 30 instead of at 20, you know, I'll be behind. But whatever it is I decide to do, I'm confident that I'll be better at it for having spent this 10 years exploring the world.
Wow.
I remember there was an image, there was an essay by the poet Robert Frost, where he uses the image, he says, he was talking about a poem, but I applied it to life. But he says, a poem, like a piece of ice on a hot grill, a poem must ride its own melting. And I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to ride my own melting and just see where life takes me when I, you know, like riding a horse, I want to let go of the reins and just see where this horse wants to go, you know? And so that's what I did. And, you know, it's led to here. But I think, you know, getting back to your question, like, what have I seen on travels that I guess I saw the incredible power of surrender, right? You can't travel, at least you can't travel well if you know where you're going. The best way to travel is where you don't know where you're going and you're not trying to control what happens. Like, I never book a room before I get there, you know, like, you know, because I, when I've done that, I've always found like, oh man, I wanted to go to this other place. I found this other place better, or I wanted to leave earlier because I met these people and they offered to take me to their, you know, place out on the beach, but I've got this room, I've already paid for it. It just, you know, that kind of security really interferes with the experience. And so, you know, you can look at that on a micro level in terms of particular travel techniques, or look at it in a macro level in terms of how do you live your life. I like to keep as much undefined as possible and just sort of, you know, adapt to things as they happen. And I find that when you approach life that way, a lot more good things tend to happen.
No, that's fantastic. When we got to the Philippines first on our travels, and we planned out every single day, and by the end of that month we were exhausted. I'd never felt exhaustion like it, and we just spent like a week on the beach somewhere, I think it's Boracay. But then after that we went rogue, and we were just where should we go next? And there's a lovely thing you've said in the past, which, by the way, before I say, it's so weird, isn't it, when you, I mean, I'm 1% of where you are as a podcaster, but when people quote things back to you that you've said and you don't actually know the person, it's such a bizarre thing. Like, I had a podcast with somebody a little while ago, and she's going, oh yeah, like you said before about your back's bad. And I was like, how does she know that? I've never said that to her before. It's a very strange thing. Obviously you'll get it tenfold, but I would go and stay in hostels because I think you said that's where you get the greatest interactions. And it was so true. Whenever we stayed in nice hotels, you wouldn't speak to anybody. Nobody wants to talk to you. You have a meal by yourself. It's all very clinical. You got your clinical room. I stayed in places where I had ants in the bed. And, you know, we stayed in the Hello Miss Kitty room in the Philippines. There's Hello Miss Kitty everywhere. It was ridiculous. It was all pink and there's ants everywhere. But do you know what? It was wonderful. It was like $10 for the night, for two people. And we got little motorbikes for $5. Anyway, it was the best. And there's something you said, which is traveling is when you're counting how many days you've been away, and a vacation is how many days you've got left. And I was like, that was it. Because I was like, oh, how long have we been going for now? I've been going for like 4 months. Oh, we can keep going, you know. But whereas you go on a two-week vacation, got 10 days left, 6 days left. And it puts this horrible pressure on you where, A, you can't enjoy it. Because if you've been away for a year or 10 years or 20 years, how can you have, you know, a two-week vacation where you really want to do what you want to do in 6 months? But yeah, that was an interesting mind shift for me, this counting up versus counting down again.
Right. And you can apply that to our earlier conversation about death.
Yeah.
Right. So many people are counting down. How much time do I have left? Right. As opposed to, man, I can't believe. I mean, I was just talking to a friend about this the other day. Because I've lived in different parts of the world, it's really sort of intuitive to, like, I had a life in Spain. I had a life in New York. I had a life in San Francisco. I had a life in Vancouver and Portland. And, you know, like, those are all lives. They're sets of friends, sets of experiences, you know? And I mean, I'm 58 now. I'll be 59 in a few days. And I feel like I've lived a dozen lives.
That's great.
You know, I mean, I maybe when I'm, you know, when I get the diagnosis, I'll have a panic of like, oh my God, but I haven't, you know, had enough time. I don't know what will happen if that comes to pass, but I do feel like, man, I've had so many lives. I can't believe I can still walk, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
My friend, he found the term epoch. I don't know if you've ever heard that term before, but it's like, I think it's another word for era, and there's all these different epochs. So for me, I've got my university life and the friendships that happened there, and traveling, and the Camino, very, very short life that happened with a very short group of friends and stuff. And maybe that's one of the keys or successes to life, is to have all, how many lives can you have within a life because at the same time, it's like, is it important to put down roots? Yes, it is. It's important to have those strong friendships that see you through the rest of your life, I think. But then at the same time, it's good to go a little bit rogue from society and go off and do these crazy things. I'm conscious of our time, so I just want to ask you a couple last questions, if that's okay. What's sure. coming up for you? Have you got any? Because I remember in one of your podcasts, you're saying that Civilized to Death had almost become two books, and so you were having to go one way with it, and there was almost a second other book. So is that still the case? Have you got anything on the back burner that's likely to come out?
Yeah, I've got a lot of things on the back burner. That's one of them, but I don't know that I really am ready to do that book that you're referring to. Because that's another like really big idea book, and it will require a lot of reading and research. And yeah, I don't know that I really want to jump into that again. I feel that I've got some other books that I'm thinking about writing that are not as intensive and heavy.
Okay.
So in fact, one of them relates to what we were talking about, at the beginning, this approach to health that is, a sort of denial of mortality and biological reality. Mm-hmm. So I have this idea for writing a book that's more sort of an embrace of, mortality and, sort of shifting attention to quality of life rather than obsessing over quantity of life, and showing how that obsession over quantity not only robs us of quality because it distracts us from gratitude and depth of experience, but also is actually counterproductive because the stress that it generates underlies a lot of the health problems that people have, you know. So it's sort of a Mediterranean, I don't want to talk about it too much because I found in the past that when I talk about books too much, it drains the energy for actually writing them. But that's something I've been thinking of. And there are, you know, various things, you know, travel tales and, you know, memoir kind of things. But I get a lot of that out on the podcast. So it's nice to feel, because, you know, I do feel like I've had experiences and I've met people that kind of give me a sense of responsibility in a way. Like, I need to tell that story. Like, that story, there's something in that that demands to be told, and it would be helpful for people to hear it. Or like, I've, you know, met these characters, like, man, I can't just let them die and be forgotten. Like, that person is so extraordinary. Like, I need to record it somehow. And it's been nice doing the podcast to be able to tell some of those stories in a way that's more spontaneous and organic, to just sit down with a beer and talk into a microphone rather than, you know, poring over a written thing for weeks or months. So that's nice. So I don't know. I might, you know, I guess I'm in a position because of the success of the first two books, where if I do write a third book, you know, it'll likely be published and, you know, there'll be financial rewards attached to it. But one of the problems of not being ambitious is that people can offer you a lot of money and it doesn't really matter, you know? Or, you know, I had an editor, after, I think maybe it was after Sexaton came out, and it was a, you know, it's in 35 languages and big bestseller and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, okay, you know, you can write a, why don't you, you know, write an op-ed for the New York Times, and, you know, then we can get something placed in, you know, on CNN, and we can do this. And you know, he put together this whole sort of media strategy, and, you know, then we'll get you on, you know, Charlie Rose or, you know, whatever it was. And I was like, no, man, I'm going to Bali or wherever it was. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like you're in the position now to do this. Do you know, like everyone wants to be where you are right now. You can take advantage of this. And I was like, no, I just want to go chill. Like I'm tired. I've been writing and editing and doing all these interviews. Like I'm done. And I remember he sort of looked at me with this confusion. He said, don't you want to be part of the national conversation? And I thought, no, not really. I don't want to be part of the national conversation because I don't think it matters. I don't, you know, I think the world's going to do, history's going to go where it's going to go. I'm not going to change that.
Yeah.
You know, so I went to Bali.
Good for you. And what that tells me is you've somebody that's got that knowing or that, obviously you've got a strong moral compass. I'm trying to think of what the right words would be, but you know your values and you're somebody, and I think that's the reason I think you've had so much success. One of the reasons is you're somebody that's got, this is me, this is my values. And you know, 99 out of 100 people would have taken that deal or wanted to be part of that conversation, that national conversation. Whereas you're the person going, do you know what? No, I know what's important to me. I'm going to go the other way. And I think that is, yeah, I respect that so much. I'm not sure I would have made the same decision, but I would want to deep inside.
Well, it's interesting to, you know, because sometimes those things come across to people as being like very principled or something. But from my perspective, it's actually quite selfish. You know, I just want to do what feels good.
Yes.
And to me, what feels good is going to Bali and lying in a hammock and, you know, having fresh coconut and pineapple and being with the woman I love. And like, that's what feels good. I've had, you know, I've seen the other side, right? Yeah. I have friends who live on mega yachts and I've been on the yacht and, you know, I have friends who are super famous and hang out with Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, and I've seen that world. I've been in that world, and I'm not trying to insult anything or anyone, but honestly, it feels much better to be in a world where people aren't that obsessed with money or fame or power or getting to Mars or, you know, amassing fortunes or changing the world. It's more fun to chill out with people who are chill, you know, and it's a lot easier to enjoy life with people who are enjoying life.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I don't mean it as any sort of like, you know, guru wisdom. I just like, it's better. Mm. It's just better. And so from my perspective, it's totally selfish.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Cause I would see it slightly differently. Have you ever heard of the author Robin Sharma? He wrote a book called The Monk That Sold the Ferrari or Sold His Ferrari. Mm-hmm. He also, it's fantastic. I only read it over Christmas, and he tells these wonderful fables about how to have a great life. And he tells it in a fictional story. It's a wonderful book. He also wrote a second book called The 5 AM Club, which is also great. But there's just a bit in there. And this keeps coming back over and over again and everything. And it's just one of those things that keeps coming to me, which is to have a great life is a life of servitude and a life where you're helping other people. And I don't know if this is, I'm misquoting you or somebody else here, but there's a story where if you give people $100 and say, go make yourself feel better, in America and England, they spent it on themselves. But in the East, they would spend that money to help other people. Am I quoting you there? Is that something you've told before?
Well, I've talked about it for sure. You know, lots of other people have as well. I mean, you know, when I'm writing about hunter-gatherers or talking about hunter-gatherers, one of the important differences between hunter-gatherer people and, you know, those of us who came after is the importance of sharing. Mm-hmm. You know, their entire society is built around sharing. I remember Charles Darwin told a story about how he was with some hunter-gatherer people, and he gave one of them a cigarette, And there were like four or five of them standing around. And that guy immediately broke the cigarette into four little pieces and gave a piece to everybody.
Yeah.
So they're all trying to smoke these tiny little cigarette nubs. And Darwin was like, you people are never going to advance because you don't understand accumulation of resources and power. And you need this hierarchy in order to advance. And of course, from Darwin's perspective, he was right. But from their perspective, it's like, why would you want to advance to a place where people don't have enough and don't share, right? It's a very different way of, one of my favorite expressions is the best place to store extra food is in your friend's stomach.
Yeah, I love that.
You know,
yeah.
And I think that's, you know, we build these worlds that are based upon values that make sense for an economy, but that don't make sense for us as individual Homo sapiens. And then we wonder why we're not happy. You know, it's like we're wearing shoes that are not shaped like a human foot.
Yeah.
It's not to be comfortable. And yet we're trying to cram our feet into these strangely shaped shoes. Much better to go barefoot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true on another level, isn't it? Touching the earth. You know, that's a whole other subject I'm sure biohackers have talked a lot about. But, you know, we don't touch the earth enough. And if you say that to somebody that doesn't really know much about that, they think, oh, that's a bit woo-woo. But then you think, well, actually, we're the only animal that's cut ourselves off from the planet. So I don't understand the magnetic reasons and all those other things. But when you start to think about it, think, it feels good to have that sand or the water or the grass between my toes. But yeah, I like the shoe analogy. You're right, it's these bad shoes. Last question for you, because I'm keen to wrap this up for you. But I've loved this, by the way. Your tomas are fantastic. And they got me to travel. And there was a quote, like you said, something along the lines of, it's a bit like a spaceship getting into space. Most of the energy is expelled trying to get you out. And when I was trying to quit my job, the amount of resistance I got, because I gave my boss 9 months notice that I was going to quit my 15-year job, because I knew we wanted to go at the end of the year. And I thought, I want to earn between now and the end. So I went to Tony Robbins' event. I visualized that I need to get out of that job of 15 years. I went in on the Monday, quit, but gave a notice till Christmas. But the amount of resistance that I got there, and I was like, oh my God. And I was almost begging for my job back several times. But then once we left, it was fantastic, you know, and then, you know, the rest is recent history. And I think, how can I judge the success of my travels? And I think back to one of your tomas, and I now have my own poo story. So when I heard your story about coming down, do you mind if I just tell it you quickly? Cause I've never shared it before. So,
sure.
So we'd got to the Philippines. It was our first destination in the East. And my belly's not good anyway. You know, it doesn't take much for it. I can look at a curry and I'll get sick. And I was always worried about traveling anyway. So I had Pepto-Bismol, tablets, liquid. I had all these different creams and ointments, just in case. Yeah, just in case. So Wim Hof actually says, what you pack in your backpack is fear and anxiety. And it's never been truer, I think. So so anyway, so I'm ready. I'm ready. Nothing's going to get me. And we get to the Philippines. All my time zones are messed up anyway. And I obviously start eating the local food and, you know, all the different enzymes and stuff that are in that food. And we get a night bus to a place called Banawi. And I just got to sleep and they started shouting, Banawi, 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 at like 4 a.m. and woke me up. And I was like, oh, all dazed. And a little man on the motorbike came and picked me and my girlfriend up. And there was nowhere for us to sit other than to kind of grab him really tight and go to the place. And anyway, we got a couple of hours sleep and went on a beautiful rice paddy field tour. Wonderful. But then my stomach started to do the thing it needed to do. And long story short, there was nowhere to go but the public path that was on the way back to the motorbike. So I left a big part of myself on that path one day, and I had to then quickly use another couple of bathrooms later. And I remember getting back on this man's motorbike and I was freezing cold. It was really hot. I was sweating. I'd been toilet, I don't know, 4 or 5 times by this point, thinking, how the hell is this happening? Poor path is destroyed. And all I could think was, I'm traveling. I'm actually traveling. This is amazing. And it was the best part. Just that feeling of, I'm dying inside, but I just feel so free. And I've just shat myself on the public path. But it's okay, because it's part of it's not okay for the other people, but it's okay for me. So anyway, so thank you, because I thought, I've got my own poo story now. And your poo story, I've heard a few times. I absolutely love that.
I think there's an important element to the poo genre of travel tale, because you know, it's metaphorical, I guess, but you're leaving behind part of you. Your digestive system is adapting to a new world, and it's like getting rid of the old world. And you're also forced to acknowledge your animality, you know, and we're so uptight about shit and the fact that we shit and the fact that we fart and that there's this kind of gross process going on. And, you know, so we, there's this weird thing in the West where we kind of like think of ourselves as like angels that are, you know, my soul is separate from all this mess going on down here. And, you know, that I think we're missing a lot of the fun that way. Right. One of the best ways to diagnose illness is to look at someone's shit, you know, and because that's a message from inside the body, what's going on there, you know, and people don't really want to hear that. But, you know, there's a, talking about African expressions, there's another expression that translates to you're very lucky if, how does this go? It's you're very lucky if you're cleaning someone's shit, because what that means is you have children or you have old people you're taking care of. You have people, you have intimate connections in your life, you know? And so it's a horror. It's gross. It stinks. It's meh. But if you have that kind of connection to other people, that's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful statement about your life.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. In a strange way.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, I think what a brilliant place to end the podcast talking about shit. So is there anything else you wanted to say to close us off, or anything we've not covered that you wanted to talk about?
No, dude, I feel like we could talk forever. Maybe we'll do a part two sometime.
I'd love to. Yeah, that'd be great.
You ask really interesting questions that, you know, lead to many different places. We haven't talked about breathing. I know that's the focus of I saw I watched your episode with James Nestor. It was really good. I haven't read his book yet, but a lot of people have recommended it to me. So I bought it, but it's on that list of books I've purchased but not yet read. I'm looking forward to it.
It's great. And it's right up your street as well, because it talks a lot about kind of, you know, going back to how people used to breathe and the things that we've lost, and how, you know, now we're not breathing with our bellies properly, and, you know, we use our mouth for breathing. I'm really, you know, I'm a couple of years into this breath journey now, but it's shocking. Like, even today I had a podcast with somebody this morning, and he was talking about all the science of breath holds and how great breath holding is for you. And it's just, you think breathing is such a narrow subject, but it goes really, really deep. But only the book's great. And I've done actually a part two with James Nestor, which has come out. I got lucky actually, because I was doing a course on breathing, and he said, "Oh, you should check out this guy." He hadn't had the book out at that point. And then the week after I did that podcast, he was on Joe Rogan, and it just went boof after that. So I felt the Rogan effect like of that.
Yeah, the Rogan bump. It's pretty significant.
Yeah. But no, it's an interesting subject all by itself. And I know obviously you spent time with Wim Hof. Did you do much breathing with him, or was it just the cold that you did?
Well, I've spent a good bit of time with Wim and his family, his son and his daughter. They're friends at this point. But I've never done the breathing. I the first time I met Wim, he agreed to do my podcast. I was in Spain at the time, and they were like, okay, we'll set up a Zoom thing. And I was like, Zoom? No, I'll fly to Holland. I want to meet this guy. And they're like, really? You fly to Holland? I'm like, yeah, I'll fly up. I have other friends in Holland, so, you know, it wasn't that big a deal. But Wim and I hit it off right away. We did the podcast, and he had filled the ice barrel before the podcast. So the ice was in there, you know, with water.
Yeah.
And after, he's like, well, you want to get in the ice with me? I was like, fuck yeah, dude, let's go. And so we just went and got in, and then we went in the sauna and went back in the ice and back in the sauna.
Nice.
And, it was awesome. But I didn't really do any breathing, but I've done breathing exercises in other contexts. So you know, I sort of know how to focus on the breath and, you know, breathe through pain or what have you.
Yeah.
But it was great. Yeah. And then we hung out in the Pyrenees for a while. And then I saw him in LA a few times. Mm-hmm. We were actually, he had rented this beautiful house up near Malibu that used to be owned by Neil Young. So we were, you know, Neil Young's old hangout for a while. That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But have you met his children?
Were they at the event? No, I met his wife, who was his girlfriend at the time. And I had a week with him.
Aaron. Yeah.
So it was wonderful.
His son is one of my favorite people in the world. His name is Anam. Mm-hmm. He's probably 35 or so now. But he is an awesome dude. And one of my favorite stories is how he was named, which tells you a lot about Wim. Okay. They're at the hospital and the baby's born and they're, you know, time to go home. And they say, well, you need to fill out these forms. So Wim is like, okay, well, what do I sign? And they said, well, what's the baby's name? And he said, well, we haven't named him yet because we want to see, like, you know, what he's like, who he is, right? Like a hunter-gatherer approach to naming.
Nice.
You don't name an infant. You wait and see, you know, what their character is.
Yeah.
And they said, no, but you can't leave without giving him a name. He has to have a name. And Wim's like, but I don't want to give him a name yet. And they're like, well, you have to do it. It's the rule. And so Wim writes on the form in Dutch, a name.
Oh, wow.
That's his name.
That's his Anam. Name. Brilliant.
Anam is a
name. I'm not surprised by that story, but it's a great story. He's such a tour de force, that guy. He's got such an energy and a passion. And, you know, being there with a week with him, there was 60 of us. And you see him every day. He's just available. Yeah, I had breakfast with him several times sitting opposite him. And you get to experience, have a few beers in the evening. He picks up his guitar. You know, playing with his dog. And yeah, it was wonderful. Just very briefly, I did the breathing exercise for about 90 minutes at one point. There's 20 of us doing it, and that I've never done any psychedelics or anything to this point, or any plant medicines, but I had the most trippy visuals I've ever had. And I had this eye come up, and I'm a bit like what you said at the start of this. I've got a story of a story of a story of a story now, so I don't quite feel what I originally felt 4 years ago. But in essence, this being, whatever you want to call it, brain dying, I don't know, it said, hey, it's so glad that you found us, it's so glad that you're here. And it was like, all right, see ya, take care. And it left again, and I just started crying and started laughing and had this, and then we all hugged together. That's 20 of us, and there's another guy, his dad had just killed himself, and I think his best friend had just killed himself, and he was crying. And we just had this big, we were strangers, we've been knowing each other maybe less than 48 hours, and we just had this big hug. And it was one of the most beautiful moments of my life. And that's the power of Wim. That's the power of breath work. And that's what set me really off on the rest of the journey. So it was a wonderful one. But yeah, crazy, crazy visuals. And I've never been able to get back there since. But it put me on a different path that day. It was, deep. So there you go. But
fantastic.
Yeah. So Chris, I will link to your books below. I'll link to your podcast as well and your website. And I just want to say thank you so much for being on here. Any last words from you before we call it a wrap?
No, I don't think so. Let's do a podcast where you come on my show.
I would love to. That'd be fantastic.
I want to hear more about the Camino and your experiences.
Okay, no, that'd be wonderful. I'll wrap it there. So guys, thank you so much for watching. This has been a real dream come true for me. Make sure you go and find all the links below and find all Chris's stuff and get his books if you haven't got them already. And Chris, then, until the next time, take care, and I'll speak to you soon, everybody. Cheers.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks for watching. Take a deep breath. Thanks for watching our Breathcast. I hope you enjoyed the guest that we just had. Just a couple of quick messages. Thank you for sticking through to the end. Really appreciate it. If you enjoyed that and you haven't subscribed, please click that subscribe button. And leave us a question or a comment, because it helps the Google algorithm. And it also means that we can interact and other people get involved and answer questions. So leave us a little question. That would be incredible. At the start, I mentioned our other YouTube channel, Hypnotherapy Unleashed. If you haven't gone over there yet, we've got a whole host of exercises in the world of hypnotherapy that can help you with addictions, anxiety, depression, and a whole other range of things that hypnotherapy can support with. So please go over there and you might find some real value over on that channel. And we're really trying to grow that community at the moment. So if you know somebody that could benefit from that and you wanted to share that, that would be really appreciated. On Instagram, you can follow me at takeadeepbreath.co.uk and we've got regular content there. And finally, in the link below, we have a breath store. So what is that? So we have taken some of our top videos. I say we, it's me. I've taken some of our top videos and converted them into an MP3 format. And for just a couple of dollars, $4 or $5, you can go to this little store. You can go through PayPal or through your debit or credit cards, all secure, legit. And you can buy one of our MP3s. And that way you're supporting the channel. But not only that, you get to keep the MP3 forever. There's no ads. There's no anything else going on. So you can listen to it on your phone, on the aeroplane when there's no signal. And that's yours to keep forever. So yeah, that's down below. And that's our breath store, which has got, I think, 8 or 9 different breathing exercises on there. We're adding more as we go. And that's it. So yeah, so thank you so much from me. And we hope to see you on the next exercise or the next breathcast. And if you're finishing this right now and you're thinking, got a few minutes spare, not sure what to do, then try one of the breathing exercises. Box breathing is a lovely way just to help slow things down and relax us. You could do some alternate nostril breathing. Just go and have a look at the channel, look at the playlists and pick something for you. Give yourself a little treat. And we will see you on the next video. Thank you very much. Cheers.